From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Bernice Johnson Reagan. In the civil rights movement, she sang with the SNCC Freedom Singers. Now she's a scholar of movement songs and the founder of the a cappella group Sweet Honey in the Rock. David Crosby became a rock star through singing with the Byrds and Crosby, Stills, and Nash. But his fame sometimes worked against him during the year he spent in prison on drug charges. In part two of our conversation, Crosby describes how he kicked his heroin and cocaine habits while in solitary confinement. And we have reviews of a new recording of Stravinsky's Histoire du Soldat, The Soldier's Tale, and of the new book by lawyer and poet Lawrence Joseph. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Bernice Johnson Reagan has sung freedom songs at civil rights marches and sit-ins, at organizing rallies, and in prison. She was a founding member of the Freedom Singers, who were affiliated with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. When the Freedom Singers disbanded, Reagan founded the Georgia-based Harambe Singers, and later the a cappella group Sweet Honey in the Rock. With Sweet Honey, Reagan continues to sing freedom songs and spirituals, and she updates these traditions with new songs written by her and by other members of the group. Reagan has also become one of America's leading scholars of freedom songs. She produced a record series called Voices from the Civil Rights Movement for the Smithsonian Institution. She also directs the Smithsonian's program in Black American culture. And she has a new book of collected songs called Compositions One. Bernice Reagan, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I want to play, before we talk about your life, I want to play an excerpt of a recent record of yours called Rivers of Life, in which you do all the voices. It sounds like a small a cappella group, but it is all you over tracking. Why did you want to record that way?
I've worked a long time with other singers, and I find that there are some things I can teach and some things I have not yet been able to convey. So with this project and technology, I'm able to come a little closer within the context of what my range is in the studio.
So you can do everything you hear in your head?
To do what I can hear in my head. I cannot perform most of those lines on a stage, but with a studio and composing, I can do it.
We're going to hear Guide My Feet While I Run This Race. Now, how did you first learn this song?
I don't know. I don't remember not knowing the song. Therefore, I probably learned it in church. And there is a part of my repertoire that seemed to have come to me by me growing up in a Black community, in a Black church, and Guide My Feet is one of those songs.
From Bernice Johnson Reagan's latest album, River of Life, and again, she's doing all the voices on that through overdubbing. Now, you dedicate that album to the singing tradition of the Black American Baptist Church, especially the Mount Early Baptist Church in Worth County, Georgia, where you were baptized. What was the singing tradition you came up in?
Well, I call it an unrehearsed congregational style. And what I mean by that is there is a way in which a song is started by a song leader, and the rest of the people in the church come in and join and actually make the song.
That's kind of what you were doing by yourself with
that's
all of
right.
your voices on
so,
the recording
so
we just heard.
That's what influences me most when I am creating choral music, that particular congregational tradition.
Now, did you sing in a choir or did the whole congregation sing together?
I sang in a choir. This style is older than what is called gospel music. When I sang in a choir, I was in a gospel choir. The first difference is you call a rehearsal, you learn the songs, you learn the part. The congregational style, there is never a rehearsal call as long as you live to learn a song, either words, text, styles, harmonies. There is no training session separate from going to church, and you learn while you are doing the singing.
Now, your father was a Baptist preacher. Did you hear much secular music when you were growing up, or was it mostly church music?
I heard secular music, but in the early years growing up, my family was fairly strict, so that they did not care that much for us listening to secular music. By the time I got to teenage, my brother, who's 2 years older than me, would get my mother's radio and take it into the room, and he would play Randy. Now, Randy out of Nashville played blues between midnight and day.
This is a disc jockey.
That's right. And I learned about Screaming Jay Hawkins, Howling Wolf, Lightning Hopkins, all of the blues, B.B. King, between midnight and day, listening to the radio coming into my room. By the time we got into high school, things had just sort of loosened up in the family so that there was more space and more permission to hear and play rhythm and blues especially, and I actually participated in a rhythm and blues group.
Now, you went to college at Albany College, which was a black college in Georgia. You were a music major when you
yes.
went to college. What kind of music were you studying?
The Euroclassical tradition. I was a contralto, so I was studying Italian arias and German lieder.
That's very interesting, since you were so steeped in the music of the church, to start singing a lieder, an art song.
Well, within the school system, the black school system, when you get to high school, if you're a singer, you begin to do anthems. You learn the Hallelujah Chorus. You learn Alleluia. You learn The Heavens Are Telling. There are staples of the Euroclassical concert tradition. You're trained to sing, and you get your first lesson in that bel canto style where you sort of cover the voice. And you learn that in high school, so by the time you go to college, you also are operating in that tradition. You could not, when I was in college, learn gospel in school. If you sang gospel, you learned it in church. Today you will find on university campuses gospel choirs. But when I was going to school, the music departments actually frowned on the traditional black vocal song style. So you never received any training in it, and you were basically told if you were considered a good soloist, that if you sang gospel, you would ruin your voice.
When you started to sing with the Freedom Singers, did you feel like you were turning your back on what you were supposed to be doing, learning more about the European singing tradition?
That decision didn't come that hard. The first thing I decided was I was going to be in the movement.
Right.
That got me put in jail. In jail, the only logical songs were the songs that had come out of the black church. The style I'd always sang those songs in were the black vocal style. And therefore, it was like I chose to be in the movement, and the movement sort of named the musical content that would work. By the time I got out of jail, I never wanted to leave the relationship I found between singing and a political position. And it was in jail where I found that you could sing a song and it would say exactly what you felt. I'd never experienced that before. But once I experienced it, I made the choice that I would stay with that and have not changed. Since that time, I have studied voice. I'm always working with a voice teacher. Most of them operate in that Euroclassical vocal tradition. And there are times in Sweet Honey when we use the coloring that is associated with it, but we don't take it seriously.
My guest is Bernice Johnson Reagan. She's the founder of Sweet Honey and the Rock. She was a founding member of the Freedom Singers, and she also directs the Black American Culture Project at the Smithsonian Institution. So let's see, what did you just say, that becoming active in the movement got you thrown out of college and into prison?
Got me thrown into prison, and then
thrown
the
out college, of
college suspended those of us who were arrested.
Why would a Black college administration throw out of college a student for their activism in the Black civil rights movement?
These are state colleges. They are state colleges in the Georgia State University system. There were three Black colleges in Georgia, Fort Valley, Savannah, and Albany State. A lot of the response of the administration was left to the administration. I actually was arrested after I had finished my final exams. So the administration could have said that this is off-campus activity, and therefore, you know, we have nothing to do with it. This is what the Black college president at Fort Valley State College said when the Georgia Education Board asked about the Fort Valley students picketing and getting arrested. His name was Troop. He said, well, they're off campus and it's we don't have jurisdiction. The Albany State Administration sent the dean of students down to the jail and got the names of those students who were registered. And we were suspended for conduct unbecoming a student of Albany State College. So that administration reached further than it needed to. And I think it has to do with what we would have called then Uncle Tom-ism, or just fear around what you have to do to keep and protect your job.
Right.
And that was a real crisis within every Black community. There were members of the community who absolutely felt totally threatened by those of us who participated in the movement and would cooperate or spy or report on us with the white power structure.
Can you describe how the Freedom Singers were founded?
Albany, Georgia was a singing movement. And when the news reporters began to come down, they came down in December 62 as a result of King being arrested. I was already in jail, so I missed most of that. But what they began to write about was the singing. No matter what the article said, they talked about singing. For the first time in my life, I realized that even Black people who came to Albany from other places were hearing singing on a level they had never heard it before. I grew up in Albany. I never knew that there was anything different about the choral congregational style in Albany. But the students who came out of Nashville to organize, Andrew Young, who came out of Louisiana with King to Albany to organize, Dorothy Cotton out of Petersburg, Virginia, came to, they all talked about the singing in Albany being like no other singing they had ever heard. And as a result of that, Cordell Regan, who was a SNCC field secretary, and James Foreman, who is executive director of SNCC, began to talk about forming a group. Pete Seeger was somebody who suggested that a group of singers traveling might actually help to build support for those parts of movement activity that did not get on the news. And SNCC was at that point trying to go into what they call Black Belt areas. These are areas in the South where Black people outnumbered whites, usually 3-1. And if we could break into voter registration in those areas, it would really turn around political power. But knocking on doors and getting people to register to vote is not the same as getting 700 people arrested. And press was very difficult to get. So the Freedom Singers came out of a need to have another kind of structure to generate support about that kind of organizing activity.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your work with the Freedom Singers and then talk about the work that you're doing now, but we're going to take a short break first. My guest is Bernice Johnson Reagan, who is a founding member of the Freedom Singers, founder of Sweet Honey and the Rock, the a cappella group, and she directs the Black American Culture Project at the Smithsonian Institution. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Bernice Johnson Reagan is my guest. We call the songs that you sang freedom songs, but some of them were spiritual, some of them were old slave songs too, weren't they?
I mean, freedom songs came out of the repertoire first, the standard repertoire of what you were singing, so that you would have a song like Paul and Silas bound in jail, had no money for to go to bail. Keep your eyes on the prize, hold on. That's a spiritual. But that song just moves straight into civil rights movement activity, and you can understand it. If you're in the Black church, you learn about Paul and Silas being locked up in jail. They were really radical SNCC workers. They are the first Christian organizers into Europe. And they go into this town, and they're preaching, and they throw them in jail. They start to sing and pray. And as a result, the jail let them out. Well, even though they preach about this in the Black church, if you grew up in a Black family, the best badge you can have is that you never got into trouble with the law. So at the same time you're preaching about these radical Christians organizing going forth, you're trying to really stay cool within your society. When you're in the civil rights movement, that's the first time you establish yourself in a relationship that's pretty close to the same relationship that used to get the Christians thrown in the lion's den. And so for the first time, those old songs you understand in a way that nobody could ever teach you. So that songs like Hold On, Eyes on the Prize, Hold On, Old Freedom, This Little Light of Mine, We Shall Not Be Moved, We Shall Overcome, all of those songs were church songs. But they got new meaning as a part of the civil rights movement. Added to that were new songs that people created.
Well, you created some new songs and changed some of the words to traditional songs. What was the first song you did that with?
Old Freedom. Over My Head, I See Freedom in the Air. That was the first demonstration in Albany, Georgia. And we had never walked in that kind of line in the city of Albany in its history. And we circled the courthouse twice. This is 1961, November. The ICC ruling, that's the Interstate Commerce Commission, had ruled that transportation across state lines could not be segregated. So students had been arrested for trying to buy tickets in the white ticket counter, and we demonstrated into support. Once we finished that demonstration, we couldn't go back to the campus, and we went to a Black church, which is the only place in the community we had to go. And I remember Charles Jones, who was a SNCC field secretary, we got in there together, and he said, Bernice, sing a song. And I started, Over My Head, I See Freedom in the Air. Well, the song really is, Over My Head, I See Trouble in the Air. Well, at that point, I did not see any trouble. So when I got down the line and got to the word trouble, trouble didn't come out, freedom came out. And the end of the line, there must be a God somewhere. So that was the first song that I changed.
You know, you must have also really had to know what song to sing under which circumstances? Because there were times probably you needed to sing a song to help organize people. Other times you needed to sing a song to help people find their courage to stand up to what was about to happen? Did you intuitively have a sense of what song to do when?
The song that you're supposed to sing that suits the occasion comes up in you if you're in the occasion yourself. So you don't have to make a list if you yourself are a part of what's happening. The song will just come up. If you're a song leader in the Black tradition, you're socialized as a song leader to know a wide range of songs, and you see people coming up with songs all of the time in church and actually at football games. Everywhere in the Black community there's music, there's this selection and picking, and usually there's never a naming, now we are going to sing. Somebody starts up a song. If they are good leaders, it's the right song for the moment. So that's something you learn.
Was there a time when you were with the Freedom Singers, an example of a time where you sang a certain song and it really kind of changed the mood or brought the mood to the next level?
The singing with the Freedom Singers is different in a way than singing in the movement on the scene. By the time we formed the Freedom Singers, we were transporting a microcosm experience. So we would be these four people standing in this hall singing and talking about the movement. But many times in the movement, one of the strongest things was a song called This May Be the Last Time. It's a song that is a powerful mood setter. You can't really sing the song without thinking about the statement you're making. And it says, this may be the last time, maybe the last time, I don't know. Maybe the last time we all sing together. Maybe the last time we all pray together. Many times, that song would be done just before a march. And it would make you know something of the potential cost that you were going into and taking the stand you were taking.
When the Freedom Singers split up and when there weren't constant rallies to sing at and demonstrations, did you feel lost for a while trying to figure out what to do with your singing and what to do with your life even?
Cordell and I got married, mm-hmm. So that I left the Freedom Singers before the Freedom Singers split up.
Oh, I see.
And I had my first child in 64. I traveled with the Freedom Singers in 63. There was another group of Freedom Singers formed, but I was being a mother in Atlanta. I had a period where I had to decide if I was going to do anything. And it was a period of deciding whether I was going to be a singer and if being a mother and a wife meant that I was not going to be a singer. Or if not being in the Freedom Singers, did that mean I was not going to be a singer? So there was a period where I had to really work at that. One wonderful thing that happened after I had my second child in 65, Toshi Seeger called me, and she asked, my baby was maybe 2 months old. She asked me to do a TV show on Woody Guthrie. It was a Camera 3 show. Now, I will never forget it because here I was with two children, and I'm sure Toshi was understanding in some way that I wasn't clear about how I was going to manage this singing. And then it was like somebody just reached down and said, come and sing. And she got tickets. I flew to New York, did the TV show. But it was very important. It says, you can have two children and you can sing. But at various points in my life, I remember one point in my life, there was a woman who was opening a club in Atlanta. And she came to my house and asked me to sing in the club. And it was called The Loving Spoonful. It was very important to me that at a time when I was trying to figure out, there were people watching me, knowing I was going through that transition, and they affirmed me every time as a singer. That was very important.
You sing now with Sweet Honey and the Rock, an a cappella group that you founded. And through that group, you are adding new songs to the repertoire, new politically inspired songs and spiritually inspired songs. But where else do you think the new songs are coming from today? The civil rights movement is not contributing songs in the way that it was. Do you think that there is a movement now that is furthering that tradition?
The civil rights movement did not stay in the black community. The civil rights movement is the movement war against Vietnam, is the women's movement, is the homosexual rights movement, is the anti-nuke movement, is the whole issue of South Africa, Central America, is an extension of the foundation laid for this period for organizing within this particular society. Therefore, all of the musicians you are hearing about now, who in addition to all of the other songs they make and record, will write songs about particular social and political issues, are doing exactly what we did, and doing more probably than the commercial artists did in the 60s. And I think that it's something that really needs to be looked at. But I think these people are a product out of the 60s, where the civil rights music, which stayed outside of the commercial industry by and large, made a major impact on what music is and what music can do. And it is influencing artists today.
You're in the unusual position of being a scholar of the movement that you contributed to. You know, you were one of the freedom singers, but now as a scholar, you have been collecting songs from the movement and going back and documenting sound recordings from the civil rights movement. Have you learned things that you weren't aware of then that were happening around you? I mean, have you gotten a different perspective as a scholar than the perspective that you had as a participant?
Absolutely. I was a SNCC worker, which means I was a radical, and I considered myself in the vanguard, and I saw everything else from that point of view. Being a scholar gives me a chance to back way up and look at a much broader picture. There were things that I didn't know about, for instance, around the March of Washington 63. I knew nothing about the mobilization happening in the labor unions with the churches, the National Council of Churches, to pull that march off. All of that knowing I have only learned as a scholar.
Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your research and your personal experiences with us. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.
Bernice Johnson Reagan directs the Black American Culture Project at the Smithsonian Institution, and she's the founder of the a cappella group Sweet Honey and the Rock. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with actor Randy Quaid. He and his brother Dennis starred in the film The Long Riders and in the off-Broadway production of Sam Shepard's True West. Quaid was a series regular on the 85-86 season of Saturday Night Live, and he portrayed Lyndon Johnson in the TV miniseries LBJ: The Early Years. I hope you can join us.
Buses are a-coming, oh yes. Buses are a-coming, oh yes. Buses are a-coming, buses are a-coming. Buses are a-coming, oh yes. Better get you ready. Better get you ready, oh yes. Better get you ready, better get you ready. Better get you ready, oh yes. Buses are a-coming, oh yes.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Some people say David Crosby lived a cliché, the famous rock star who almost lost everything because of drugs. Coming up in part two of our interview, David Crosby talks about the reality of his recent life, his year in prison on drug charges, and the challenge of staying straight since his release. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new recording of Stravinsky's Histoire du Soldat, The Soldier's Tale, featuring performances by Vanessa Redgrave and Sting. And Stuart Klawans has a review of Curriculum Vitae, a collection of poems by lawyer Lawrence Joseph. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl says the Soviet Union has promised to free all Soviets considered by the West to be political prisoners. But Kohl's statement in Moscow today did not say whether the pardon applies to some religious prisoners not usually defined by the Soviets as political prisoners. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
Kohl said the prisoner pardon came up during 3 days of meetings here between top West German and Soviet officials. He said the West Germans were told that the prisoner release would be finished before the end of this year. West German officials indicated that pardons would be given to prisoners whose cases have been identified by Western governments. They said they didn't know how many prisoners might be freed. Foreign Ministry spokesman Gennady Gerasimov's refusal to confirm the release added to confusion about just what the Soviets might have promised. Some Moscow human rights activists said they're doubtful that all prisoners of conscience will actually be released by the end of the year. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Michael Dukakis met with Hispanic leaders in Denver today to discuss ways to improve voter turnout on Election Day. Dukakis speaks Spanish and has frequently used it in his stump speeches in Hispanic areas. He hopes to use Spanish language advertising and get out the vote drives to boost turnout in Texas, California, Colorado, and New Mexico. Vice President George Bush, following a speech in Michigan this morning, is campaigning in South Dakota and Montana on his way to Washington State. NPR's Jim Angle is traveling with the Republican presidential candidate.
Bush spoke to supporters in a stockyard in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, before heading to Billings, Montana. The two states combined only have 7 electoral votes, but Press Secretary Sheila Tate said it was convenient to make these stops on the way to the West Coast, and that Bush's lead in the two states is narrow and soft. Earlier in Detroit, Bush said Dukakis' criticism of Reagan tax cuts sound like someone who is just itching to repeal one of the most successful economic policies in our history.
He has proposed mandated new spending, both by government and by business, that will cost, as Carl Sagan might say, billions and billions and billions.
Bush, too, has proposed billions in new programs, but he did not mention that today or how he would pay for them. He said only that he would limit spending increases to the rate of inflation. I'm Jim Angle with the Bush campaign in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
The Commerce Department said today the economy showed only modest expansion in the third quarter. The gross national product rose 2.2%. The trade deficit helped to slow the pace of economic growth. Commerce Department spokesman Robert Ortner said the drought also contributed to the 0.6% decline from the previous quarter.
The slowdown there was essentially in a drop in agricultural exports. Non-agricultural exports continued to do well, growing at about a 10% annual rate in the third quarter.
Ortner predicted economic growth would pick up again in the final 3 months of the year, reflecting further improvement on the trade front and continued consumer and business spending. A federal judge in Washington today ordered the State Department not to interfere with Rabbi Meir Kahana's plan to enter the United States for a speaking tour. Kahana, who founded the militant Jewish Defense League, is challenging a government finding that he renounced his U.S. citizenship. Kahana sought reinstatement after Israel's high court banned his party from fielding a candidate in the Jewish state's upcoming elections. The Brooklyn-born Kahana is a member of the Israeli parliament. Stock prices were lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 8 points to close at 2165.18. Declines led advances 4-3 on volume of 182 million shares. Average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 11 cents. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Histoire du Soldat, or The Soldier's Tale, is one of Igor Stravinsky's most popular works. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz has a review of a recording of this theater piece on the new Pangea label, owned by the rock star Sting. It features an all-star British cast, Sting, Vanessa Redgrave, and Ian McKellen.
Down a hot and dusty road, tramps a soldier with his load. He has to spend. Will his journey never end?
Histoire du Soldat is one of Stravinsky's freshest and most characteristic works. Lively, charming, sinister, full of surprises no matter how many times you hear it. He said the music was inspired by jazz, which at the end of World War I, when he wrote the piece, he actually hadn't heard yet. He'd only seen some ragtime sheet music. Histoire du Soldat is on a more intimate scale than Firebird, Petrushka, and The Rite of Spring, Stravinsky's three great ballet masterpieces written just before the war. It was conceived as a theater piece for three actors, a dancer, and only seven instruments, the size of a jazz combo. The story, allegorical and satirical, is based on folk legends. A young soldier on his way home from war meets the devil, who wins the soldier's fiddle in a bargain, and ends by capturing his soul. Stravinsky urged producers to feel free to give the setting contemporary significance. He said it was his only theater piece that referred to contemporary events. In 1920, the ever-practical Stravinsky condensed the music into an instrumental suite, which he recorded three times. He never recorded the complete theatrical version. He must have sensed that actors get tiresome on repeated hearings, which the music alone never does. The new recording is surprisingly successful for an all-star production. The rhymed English translation is pointed and pungent. The esteemed British Shakespearean actor Ian McKellen is a compelling, witty narrator. And Vanessa Redgrave makes a tasty, if overspiced, ham casserole out of her many-voiced, multi-ethnic devil. Best of all is Sting as the soldier, unactorish, funny, and touchingly believable. A most appealing working-class anti-hero.
A little old man approaches, carrying a butterfly net.
Give me your fiddle.
No.
Sell it me.
No.
I'll give you this book for it, then.
Can't read.
Oh, makes no difference. There's no need. With this book, you don't have to read. It's more than a book. It's wealth untold. You've only to open it. Lo and behold, banknotes, bearer bonds, and gold.
Well, I should want to have a look.
Certainly, certainly. Here's the book.
On sight, collateral, note of hand. This book's not easy to understand.
I can read it all right, but it's still Greek to me.
You will understand it. Wait and see.
The young American conductor Kent Nagano and the first-rate London Sinfonietta play an authoritative, state-of-the-art edition of this problematical score. The performance is appropriately lean and jazzy. But there's more character in the music than Nagano conveys. The playing should be at least as characterful as the acting. Nagano can't quite capture the rhythmic delicacy, that special quality of Stravinsky's that makes a listener shiver with poignant irony. As does, for example, the very classy version of Istvar recorded in 1962 by Igor Markevich and narrated in the original French by Jean Cocteau, with Peter Ustinov as the devil. It's just been reissued by Philips in its budget-priced CD series, Legendary Classics. There's also a fascinating recent performance of the instrumental suite on a Mobile Fidelity Sound Lab CD with the superb Soloists Ensemble of the Bolshoi Theater, a version that emphasizes introspective Russian melancholy, maybe at the expense of some of the brashness, but still a good antidote to Nagano's more streamlined brilliance. No one, however, has ever conducted this scintillating music better than its own composer.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new recording of Stravinsky's Histoire du Soldat on the Pangea label. This is Fresh Air. In the late 60s and early 70s, David Crosby was famous for his vocal harmonies with the Byrds and Crosby, Stills, and Nash. But he soon became equally famous as the picture of the rock star who had self-destructed. A 15-year addiction to heroin and cocaine undid him physically and mentally. In 1985 and 86, he spent a year in Texas prisons on drugs and weapons charges. Yesterday, we discussed his life up to his imprisonment. Now we pick up the story in part two. I asked him if he was terrified of serving time in prison.
That was the reading everybody put on it, but the actual fact was I was afraid of kicking. Uh-huh. I just didn't want to stop. The majority of my psyche at that point was entirely, totally concerned with satisfying the drug, you know, desire. And that was all I cared about, and I would have said, done anything to avoid having to go through stopping.
Well, let me ask you this. Shortly before you went into jail, you were checked into a couple of hospitals, and some of the medical reports from those hospital stays are reprinted in your autobiography.
Mm-hmm, yeah, we did that on purpose.
Well, let me just read a little bit of it. One of the hospital reports describes you as a disheveled man who appears his stated age and is slightly obese. The second ends with, finally, it must also be noted that his current embitteredness and sense of despair are related to his lifelong inability to cope with externally imposed confinement. It is in this context, then, that suicidal attempts cannot be ruled out should he be forced to spend a significant time in jail. Did you ever try to take your life while you were in jail?
No, you know, it's odd. I have never been suicidal. I've never felt suicidal. I've never tried to take my own life, and I certainly didn't in prison. In actual fact, the toughest part of my incarceration was in the county jail, where they had me in solitary for a long, long, long time.
Why were you in solitary?
Well, they were making an example of me, for one thing. You know, they'd say, hey, look here, we got us a rock star. They also were a little afraid to put me in population in the county jail because they were afraid that somebody would, you know, just, knife me in the food line or something, and that they would have to deal with the consequences.
So you had to go through withdrawal while in solitary confinement?
I did, yeah, in a steel box about the size of your closet. And they didn't let me out for anything. They just fed me through a hole in the door. And the the description of a drug detox in a in the Texas Texas Department of Corrections is sort of like this. It goes sort of like, hey, you got yourself like this here. You get yourself out of it, boy. And that's about as far as it goes. They didn't give me an aspirin. You know, I mean, it was just, it was awful.
So, but it meant in a way that you had to find your own resources because no one was there to help you.
That's right. When I did go to prison, it was because I asked to go. I could have done the rest of my sentence in county jail, but I asked them please to send me down to Huntsville because that way I could get in population and have people to talk to, be able to get books to read, be able to be in the prison band, which was a big deal. I really, when I started to, you know, to wake up, I wanted to play guitar very badly. And you nut up just sitting there in a little box and not being able to do anything.
What kind of treatment did you get from your fellow prisoners when they knew that you were a rock star and that you were there on drug charges?
It ran the gamut, you know. It went all the way from, hey, yeah, hey, man, I've always loved your music. It was real good. Hey, man, are you Crosby? Hey, that's real good music. I mean, it's not as good as George Strait, but it's real good. Completely abusive hatred, you know, from people that you know, saw me as a symbol of, you know, rich kids that they you know, hate it. They've never had a dime, you know, they never had two pair of shoes. And to see somebody that they knew had had Ferraris and, you know, yachts and stuff like that, it was just a symbol for them, and they hated me.
Mm-hmm. You describe at one point how you really impressed everyone in prison by showing you could pick a lock, and they had a new high esteem for you, knowing that you could be a criminal also.
Yeah. Well, in there, the doper is a very low, low status criminal. When I managed to, it was just sheer luck, man. The guy handed me the only lock I'm really proficient at picking. And when I picked it quickly, you know, he thought, you know, hey, this is pretty dang impressive. This guy actually, he knows how to do real crime. So that gained me access to an air-conditioned room that I used to be able to go into every once in a while. I'll tell you, that was nice.
Really? And should I ask how you learned how to pick a lock in the first place?
A friend of mine showed me, just something to do while you're sitting around loaded.
Oh, okay. How were you able to get a guitar in prison?
I wasn't. It's a completely false concept. People said I had one. I didn't.
So you just sang?
I could get access to a guitar when I played in the band. When I went out to the room that we rehearsed the band in, that was the, quote, music room, unquote, then I could get access to a guitar for an hour or two at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But they certainly do not and never have let anybody have guitars in their cells.
So you were what, guitarist and singer in the band?
Yeah, when I came in, they were thrilled. You know, they said, "Hey, wow!"
What kind of music had they been playing?
Rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they were pretty darn good. There were some talented people in there. The guy who was the lead guitar player in the band is still there and always will be. He's doing life for murder.
This was, as you describe it, your first time playing and singing straight. You were so used to performing high.
Yeah, this was the first time.
What was the difference for you?
It's a big difference. At first, it was very uncomfortable. After a while, you get to like it. And now I think I'm much better at performing straight than I was high. When I see film or video of me trying to perform stoned now, at least from the latter part of it, I am impressed with how bad I was.
When you were in jail, it would have been very difficult for you to get access to drugs, even if you wanted to. So staying clean was perhaps not quite as hard as it was when you actually got out, when one does have access to whatever one wants. Was there, like, a new challenge for you after you got out of prison to stay clean?
Yes. It was probably the thing I was most afraid of. You know, because I had done this once before. I did some time in the county jail and went out and instantly went right back on it. And I was very afraid about it. But I had more time under my belt this time. And I had the support of my now wife. And when I got out, you know, we looked at each other and said, well, you know, what do you want to do? We both wanted to get loaded. We both had a strong craving to do it. And we said, shall we? You know, because we knew we could. And we both said, nah, you know, like, we've got a chance now. Let's try not to. And we'd already tried dying. We thought we'd try living.
What about going on the road? Is that hard?
Yeah, it was harder at first. You know, sometimes somebody will come up to me and say, hey, you want a little pick-me-up, you know? And at first I would get mad, you know. I would think to myself, God, doesn't this ignorant fool know who I am and how much trouble I got in? And how can they do this? But it's you know, the longer I stay straight, the more easily I can handle it. And it's gotten to the point now where if somebody offers me something, I just say, no, I don't do that. And I just keep going, you know, just keep walking.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you very, very much for talking with us.
That's my pleasure.
David Crosby's autobiography, Long Time Gone, is published by Doubleday. He has two forthcoming records, one solo and one with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. This is Fresh Air. Renee Montaigne is joining us with a preview of All Things Considered. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, we have a report out of Moscow today. The Soviet government has confirmed that within the next 10 weeks, it plans to release all people considered by Western countries to be political prisoners. Western sources say the number should come to around 200 people. The Soviet officials are putting it into the dozens. And so we shall see how many people do get released and who they turn out to be. Also, new figures on economic growth. It turns out the growth economically in this country has slowed down in the third quarter of this year. Not such good news. John Itzty reports tonight on George Bush's plan to reduce the federal budget deficit. It's his flexible freeze, and we explain it.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Curriculum vitae is Latin for the course of a life, in other words, a resume. It's also the title of a new book of poetry by Lawrence Joseph, a man whose own resume is somewhat unconventional. Critic Stuart Klawans has a review of Curriculum vitae.
Lawrence Joseph is a kind of secret agent. He operates undercover in law offices, and contracts are drawn up, and people talk in billions of dollars. He can pass in these surroundings because he is himself a lawyer. As he puts it, I make favors, complain, wear a white shirt and blue suit. But he's a spy all the same. Under the blue suit is a poet who keeps trying to unite the precision of law with all sorts of other things. His family history, his love life, the Catholic Church. Within a single poem, he's likely to jump from the financial markets to the terrible history of Lebanon, where his grandparents came from, and then finish up in New York City, where Joseph the secret agent prowls in search of incongruities. Here's how he does it in a poem titled, That's All. He's about to launch himself into a passage that's part religious, part legal, part autobiographical. Notice how it all turns on the different meanings of the word witness. Firsthand, I now see the God whose witness is revealed in tongues before the exchange on Broad Street. and the transfer of $2,675,000,000 by tender offer are acts of the mind and the calculated truths of First National City Bank. Too often, I think about third cousins in the Shouf. And with the mention of the Shouf in Lebanon, we're back to his family history. As you may have gathered, Joseph is not the world's most cheerful poet. He isn't without humor, it's just that irony is more his style. A poet working with his ambitions, a lawyer poet especially, is going to depend less on charm than on a finely balanced sense of form, a moral consciousness. Joseph is obsessed with morality, and also a lot of harshly honest autobiography. To give you the idea, I'd like to read part of my favorite poem in the collection. It's called There I Am Again, and it has to do with the grocery store that Joseph's father ran in the slums of Detroit. Today again, in the second year of the fifth recession, my father holds pickled feets, stomachs and hearts. I lift crates of okra and cabbages, let down crates of buttermilk and beer, bring live carp to the scale, and come at last to respect the intelligence of roaches in barrels of bottles. I sell the blood on the wooden floor after the robbery, salt pork and mustard greens and silver satin wine, but only if you pay, down, on the counter, money you swear you'll never hand over. Only if, for collateral, you don't forget you too may have to kill. Strong stuff. If you've sometimes felt, as I do, that a lot of the poetry making the rounds these days is pretty insubstantial, then I think you'll welcome Lawrence Joseph. I don't know of too many other writers who would talk about murder and collateral in the same breath. That takes real nerve, and the intelligence of both a lawyer and a poet. Curriculum Vitae is available in bookstores, or directly through the publisher, the University of Pittsburgh Press, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 15260.
Stuart Klawans writes about film for The Nation magazine. He reviewed Curriculum Vitae, a collection of poems by Lawrence Joseph. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, I speak with one of TV's pioneering women, Marlene Sanders. She started as Mike Wallace's production assistant and eventually rose to anchor of the CBS news breaks. Her new book, Waiting for Prime Time, looks at her own path and that of other top women news correspondents and assesses their contributions to television journalism. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Stay Awake, the new collection of songs from Walt Disney movies performed by musicians like Tom Waits, Bonnie Raitt, and Ringo Starr. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Lair of the White Worm, the new horror film by director Ken Russell. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Fred Landerl, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.